This episode is brought to you by Shared Interest. Shared Interest's mission is to provide finance that transforms lives, providing a hand up, not a hand out, to some of the most disadvantaged communities across the globe. By investing with Shared Interest, you can help farmers and artisans around the world earn fair incomes and trade their way out of poverty to build a fairer, more sustainable future. Shared Interest, where your money makes a world of difference. Visit the link in our show notes to learn more. Welcome to The World Unspun. I'm your host, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. Today's guest is no stranger to the public eye.
I'm responsible to build another world, and Palestine is what I'm responsible to speak on today.
Francesca Albanese is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Albanese worked for a decade as a human rights expert for the UN, including in Jerusalem for the UN's agency that supports Palestinian refugees. But over the last 2 years, she has stepped out of the United Nations structures to speak directly to the world's people about the ongoing genocide in Palestine.
I think Gaza has been a revealer. Palestine has been a revealer of the fragility of fundamental rights and freedoms for all of us.
Considered persona non grata by Israel, Albanese is perhaps one of the most hated and admired figures in the United Nations today. Appointed in 2022 as the first woman to do the role, her life has been consumed by the unpaid and under-resourced position, especially since October 2023. Unlike many Western diplomats, the Italian human rights lawyer has called Israel's assault on Gaza a genocide, and she has urged Israel's suspension from the UN. This stance has made her a target of smear campaigns, with the U.S. mission to the UN accusing Albanese of, quote, anti-Semitic hatred and impartiality when her term was renewed in April. The U.S. also hit her with sanctions in July in retaliation for her latest report on who profits from genocide, which you can read via the links in our show notes.
The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio posted on X saying, I am imposing sanctions on UN Human Rights Council Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese for her illegitimate and shameful efforts to prompt international criminal court action against US and Israeli officials, companies, and executives. He also said her campaign of political and economic warfare against the United States and Israel will no longer be tolerated.
Albanese's term has reshaped the boundaries of what it means to hold power to account. From openly naming Israel's illegal occupation to calling out the arms trade, tech companies, and academic complicity in enabling its genocide to continue.
Palestinians are dying. People are profiting from it. It's shocking. It's disgusting.
She speaks not just as a legal scholar, but as a witness of history repeating itself and of the silence that enables it.
Israel is an apartheid state just committing a genocide. How can I cheer Israel? History will judge us.
And yet, despite the smears, threats, sanctions, and isolation, Albanese is undeterred.
It's like the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish used to say, I'm not mine. Right now, I'm not mine anymore. I need to help.
My colleague Bethany Riley spoke to Albanese for our latest issue on the UN at 80. Speaking from her home in Tunis, she appears to place more faith in grassroots power than in the UN's headquarters. Stay tuned for their conversation.
So thank you so much for talking to me. I would just firstly like to start by asking you if you could explain what you see the role of UN Special Rapporteur to mean and require from someone who takes on the role.
And I want to say to those people who are fighting against the pressure and the repression, keep moving, keep doing what you're doing, keep resisting.
Special rapporteurs are independent experts, human rights experts, mandated by the United Nations to document and report on a given human rights situation, which can be thematic, for example, the right to food or the right to health, the freedom of expression, situation of human rights defenders globally. And then there are a few of us, 14 of us out of 50, whose job is to monitor, document, and report a given human rights situation and the violations of international law connected to it in a given country. So my mandate is to monitor and report violations of international law in the occupied Palestinian territory, the territory that Israel has occupied since 1967 against the law, namely the Gaza Strip, East Jerusalem, and the West Bank. And special rapporteurs should be able to visit the place under their monitoring. And to this mandate, this has been prevented since 2008. My predecessor was arrested, detained, and deported as he tried to visit the occupied Palestinian territory in 2008. And since then, Israel has done everything possible to prevent us from visiting.
And you've taken a sort of different approach, from my understanding, from your predecessors in the way that you use kind of more non-diplomatic and frank language to speak about what's going on in Palestine. What have you done differently?
I think that we need to assess which circumstances we are operating against. And I don't think that any of my predecessors has ever faced a situation that is as serious, as unacceptable, as abominable as this one. If you listen to other rapporteurs, they are as frank, candid, and direct as I am. And I don't know if we are not diplomatic. I mean, certainly if diplomacy is a word for hypocrisy and mincing the words, yes, we're not diplomatic. But I do think that we are diplomatic in the way we try to convey and talk to member states and try to advise them on how they should behave according to international law. So the situation today is falling apart if we look at it from an international law lens. And what I've done differently from my predecessors, I don't think that the analysis and the rigor of the analysis is more. It's just that I've gone deeper into certain questions like that. And I've gone deeper, but I've also exposed the global structure of the system. So for the infrastructure of the occupation, the perpetual, perennial, intentional, structural violation of the right of self-determination of the Palestinian people, the carcerality system, which is systemic and widespread. And so in a way, I have zoomed in certain questions, and then there has been the genocide. And again, now there is, I mean, when I issued my first report saying that there were reasonable grounds to believe that Israel might have committed acts of genocide, I was pretty much a lonely voice inside the United Nations. Although this is a bit unfair because other special rapporteurs had in fact joined a number of communications where I was warning member states of the risk of genocide committed by Israel, Israel first and foremost, and then public statements. So it was us, special rapporteurs, and I took the lead in this. And now there is a world consensus in the human rights community, and many, including in Israel, are condemning the operations, the ongoing operations, as genocidal. So again, what is very different is my engagement with the media. I've had an open door policy to media, and I've also used non-traditional media, social media. I've been proactive rather than responsive. This is one thing. And the second thing is that I've accepted invitations to go to capitals. And this was part of my vision as a special rapporteur. I mean, it's in my letter of when I communicated with the Human Rights Council on what I would do if I were a special rapporteur. I said I would engage more with the diasporas, the Palestinian, the Jewish diaspora. And I would definitely spend more time in capitals because the decision making happened there.
And because of those differences, I mean, do you think that your predecessors could have done more within the scope of the role of UN Special Rapporteur?
I don't know. I have so much admiration and respect. I mean, when I think, look, I mean, for me, one pivotal moment in really my understanding of Palestine, because it's not that everything has been as clear as it is now. Now I see what Palestine is. It's been like peeling an onion, and it's getting closer and closer and closer to the reality as in its pure essence. But I remember, so first of all, in 2005, 2006, Don Dugard, who was a special rapporteur before Richard Spock, denounced what Israel was doing as resembling apartheid. So this is why people seemed not to noticed. Member state didn't want to notice, but it was groundbreaking because I think it was the first time that the word apartheid was used by an independent expert. This vis-a-vis Israel. And the second is Richard Falk. Richard Falk was an absolute inspiration. I mean, he's not just a giant in legal studies, international legal studies. He's been in his 90s and he keeps on being engaged on the question of Palestine. And as a Jewish person, he has taken so much hatred against him, including from people in his own religious community. Turning point for me was when in 2017, Michael Link published the report on illegality of the occupation. And this was a pivotal turn because I had worked in Palestine. And so we were assessing Israel's conduct as breaches of international humanitarian law. The illegality of the occupation had never been contested until Michael Link wrote that report saying, there is International Court of Justice jurisprudence that in the case of Namibia that assesses that an occupation cannot live in perpetuity. It must be temporary. It must respect life and rights of the occupied people. It cannot turn into acquisition of land by force. And this is all what the Israeli occupation had been doing. So it was not just violating the laws of war. It was constituting a crime of aggression. It was itself an act of war. And this was phenomenally important.
So it's kind of more, it's like the strength of the criticism and all of the language was there, but it's maybe in the way it was communicated that it didn't come across, or that just people weren't receptive to listening. And maybe they're listening more now.
You know, because they were speaking mainly within the United Nations system, and I've gone straight out of it convincingly, but this was my intention. I said I will bring the message outside the UN, because the UN, even the stones in the UN, if they could speak, they would tell the story of Palestine and Israel-Palestine. Nothing changes because the political will is not there. It's not in New York. It's not in Geneva. It's in capitals. And we need to go there and also speak to the people. I trust the people. I think Gaza has been a revealer. Palestine has been a revealer of the fragility of fundamental rights and freedoms for all of us, including in Europe, in the UK, in Italy, in Germany, in France. The fact that people have been prevented from exercising their fundamental rights, like freedom of association, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, really serious, and that sounded an alarm for so many. It has, but not fast enough.
And what do you think the limitations, if any, of the role are?
So many limitations. I mean, I'm a volunteer, and sacrifice it takes us economically of not being rely on volunteers who want to support the money, the support we get from the United Nations. I mean, I've been helped by ordinary good advisors from the UN. I have one advisor from the UN, the rest. It's me and volunteers, researchers, and the internet. Incredible. And do without Maya, with a good will of people. And then they also, the limitations have turned every challenge into an opportunity. Yeah, I have no budget, doesn't matter. I will rely on the solidarity of the people. So there are so many academics listening to me, helping me work out certain things, because I will not be an expert on everything. Yes, I am a human rights expert, a refugee law expert, but until last year, 16, 17 months ago, I had to really go through the entire jurisprudence on genocide. And there are genocide scholars who have been siding with me, really helping me understand. And now I became an expert, but against my will, I was forced to do that. But, and then other things, I mean, there is so much demand for me traveling, from South Africa to Colombia. And I don't have budget for that. It's a civil society, sometimes state authorities who really demand my time. So this is how it works. The challenge is the real challenge is and there are two, which are known to those who stand in solidarity with the Palestinians as they are getting slaughtered. One is it's Israel itself, and it's lies politically, the sense of denialism, the fact they really don't want to see the Palestinians as individuals. It's like if the Palestinian had brought havoc upon themselves. Of course, what happened on October 7 was a massacre. And no Israeli civilians should have been touched. Of course, saying that people like me and my predecessors have repeated for decades, civilians cannot be touched and the occupation must end. And had Israel withdrawn the occupation and stopped practicing apartheid against the Palestinians before, October wouldn't have happened. I'm sure of it. And so, you know, there is the denial of the context and this ironclad support for Israel and also the smears, the attacks. I mean, the silence, this genocide is continuing unabated because of the silencing of anti-genocide voices.
Yeah, and the smearing has affected you a lot as well.
I think so. It has made me stronger. I don't know. I've never changed. I mean, sometimes I'm less available to the media like now. Not because there has been a smear campaign. I don't care about the smears. Seriously, I can't even hear them anymore. Of course, I'm concerned about my safety, my family, and this is human. But the rest, I don't care. I mean, of course, they've ruined my reputation. But it's like the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish used to say, I'm not mine. Right now, I'm not mine anymore. I need to help because I grew up educated to recognize discrimination and racism. I mean, all this effort that my country has made in educating future generation, new generation, about the horrors of the Holocaust had to mean something, right? And again, the fact that an entire people is treated as an enemy, as an encumbrance that you can get rid of. And this is something that is somewhat unacceptable, but I'm absolutely unaffected.
That's good to hear. I guess I kind of mean it's something that has been targeted, like you've been targeted, and the US mission to the UN again strongly denounced your position and said that the United Nations tolerates anti-Semitic hatred, bias against Israel, and the legitimization of terrorism. This doesn't impact the work that you do when you hear these things. And do you feel also supported by the human rights community when you face these?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And me telling them, don't worry. Don't worry. Go ahead. You shouldn't spend time on me. Because people write to me and say, what can we do for you? Nothing. Nothing. Keep on working. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. Don't listen to them. Those who need to protect me are United Nations and member states. And if they fail, it's their failure. I mean, for example, the U.S. has so much pressure on the UN, including threatening to withdraw funds so that my mandate were not renewed. This is where I took a step back. I went to the countryside with my family, with my friends, and I said, if they decide that I don't have their trust anymore, let it be. I'm fine. I'm not their employee. I'm someone who's operating under their trust. And the moment member states don't have my trust, that's okay. I will continue. And then you will see how undiplomatic I can be. Because now I'm being very respectful of member states. Because if I had to be honest and say what I think of some of them, then I would be very undiplomatic. Some colleagues of mine have chosen the undiplomatic way. This is not my style as a special rapporteur. I really believe in decorum and in respect for the rules. Frankly, seeing how the rules are violated in the United Nations as well. I mean, being accused from the US, look at what they're doing to their own citizens. Transgender, look what they're doing to their residents, to students. These are the minds that we are forming, we are helping to form to lead us tomorrow. And we punish them for being responsible citizens. They are accusing me of that ugly thing because I criticize Israel. Of course I criticize Israel. Israel is an apartheid state just committing a genocide. How can I cheer Israel? History will judge us.
That's the word hypocrisy comes to mind.
By the way, a country which was birthed from a genocide, actually from genocide, the hundreds of genocides of hundreds of Native American communities, and started history conveniently from, you know, the day after. This is the thing. Palestine has forced us to turn the page. We need to look at ourselves in the mirror. We Europeans, me, Italian, you, British, and others listening to us, we need to look into the mirror and see who we are as societies. And we are the descendants of colonizers who have imposed their authority to depredate other countries, peoples, and lands. And we continue to do that. I don't want to be part of such a society. I'm responsible to build another world, and Palestine is what I'm responsible to speak on today.
Have there been moments that you felt that your role as Special Rapporteur has been undermined by other roles that the UN has in Palestine and on the international stage?
No, there have been moments where I wonder, am I undermining the mandate with my Jean-Dac approach? Sometimes, yes, I've wondered. I do think, and I've asked people, I've asked my predecessors, I've asked member states, not the US, yet doesn't talk to me, otherwise I would have asked them. And the answer is, if you're not there, we lost. So there is a huge sense of reassurance. I do think that the UN, I look forward to the day I will not be in the UN anymore, because I really want to write about what I see today. Eyal Weissman calls the humanitarian paradox. I've spoken about that before, saying that the UN, by not challenging the structural injustice in Palestine, was being sort of complicit. Not complicit in a legal sense, but somewhat was normalized. This is the term I use, was normalizing the occupation. And this is why I was happy to leave the UN at a certain point, because I felt distressed by the way we were imposing donors' agenda on the Palestinians, who were oppressed by the occupation, were oppressed by their own authorities to an extent. And on top of this, there was the conditionality of the donors. And which is important, because you see, even by respecting that conditionality, the UN, like UNRWA, have been accused to support terrorism, to shelter terrorists, which is pure nonsense. It's nonsense. But yes, I think that now I see much more. Again, Palestine, I keep on saying, and especially if there are young people in the audience, I would like you to watch this movie, Matrix, because for me, Palestine has been the red pill. There have been moments where I felt the pain and the shock, because it's a red pill, it has a continuous release, but it allows you to see the world in its monstrosity, also its beauty. Also its beauty. And I would like, especially young people, I have little hope for people of my generation and beyond. We are too corrupted by the lifestyle, by the capitalist lifestyle we are in. Capitalism is not part of the natural world order. It's been there for 300 years. But what's happening to Palestine, the reason why we cannot stop the genocide is also, and this is what my next report will be about the intricacy of private interest. And I feel the tears in my eyes when I say this word. It's profit. Palestinians are dying. Someone else, yes, there is the ideology, there is the fury of those in the Israeli government, their personal interest. But profits. People are profiting from it. It's shocking. It's disgusting.
And it's the arms companies. Those are the top profiteers.
Look, they are. But when you go deeper, when you see the AI tools and those who own them, when you see the tech industry, which Israel has become the startup nation for, and the charities and universities, how much money they invest, including in your country, in the tech/military industry. Of course, they know what they are doing. And this is why there is so much repression on the students, which I do. I really hope that they will continue to stay strong, principled, and steadfast. They cannot arrest you all. They cannot expel you all. We need to become a storm of principled people. Uh-huh. They need to speak and breathe human rights. This is for us. It's for us and for our future. The problem is we need to understand that the concept of left has been so contaminated in your country, in my country. We need to look at the people. not at the parties. I keep on insisting, decolonization, decolonizing the mind means bringing down the barriers, breaking the silence and breaking the silos. This is what I keep on telling people these days. And I've learned, it's not that I'm a guru. I'm just someone who talks a lot to people and hears them and sees the global movement and tries to make sense, connecting the dots. I see a revolution brewing. I do see that. I can hear that. And I see the pressure and the repression. And I want to say to those people who are fighting against the pressure and the repression, keep moving. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep resisting. Keep asking for the application of justice. And then it should be my generation, professionals, those who are already have a job, the journalists, the scholars, anyone. We need to mobilize to protect what we have. And what we have today is going to get lost. The freedom to think, the freedom to speak. And also, these are necessary because if they take rights away from us, disabled people, transgender people, people with health issues, the health system, we need the right to protest, right? We need it. And now it's getting jeopardized. Today is on Palestine, tomorrow will be about something else. This is the crude lesson that we have not learned from the past, I'm afraid.
That was Francesca Albanese speaking to my colleague Bethany Riley. This interview was originally recorded in April 2025. In July, Albanese was among those to attend the Hague Group's conference in Bogota, Colombia, where a group of 12 states from across the Global South made history by announcing unprecedented measures to stop Israel's genocide in Gaza. These include an arms embargo on Israel, a ban on ships carrying weapons from docking at their ports, a commitment to defend international law, and a unified call for an immediate ceasefire.
These are not just measures. These are lifelines for a people who are under relentless assault and a world that has been paralyzed for too long.
The Hague Group was formed earlier this year to campaign for the enforcement of international law and court adjudications against Israel that are, quote, guided by the purposes and principles enshrined in the Charter of the United Nations. States have until September 20th to sign on to the final resolution. Thanks for listening to today's episode. If you were inspired by what you heard and want to read more of our reporting on the UN at 80, including the key principles for reform, subscribe to New Internationalist via the link in our show notes. Don't forget to use the code THEWORLDUNSPUN at checkout for 20% off the first year of your print and or digital subscription. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Maxine Butteridge-Mose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Amy Hall, Bethany Riley, Conrad Landon, and Nick Dowson. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Fuz. Audio editing is by Nasik Hamza. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.